It's our penultimate episode. This episode, we meet the Democratic candidates who are vying for district attorney. They will have a say potentially in Sean's upcoming fourth trial. So let's go ahead and dive in, shall we? So we first meet Stephen Bannister, who was a Walgreens employee on the day of Mulligan's murder. In fact, he was the one who found him. So he had gone for coffee, and when he came back, he knocked on the window, and that's when he saw the blood on his face. From there, he went in to his manager, and they called the police. He, unfortunately, still has nightmares about it to this day. Rosemary is going over the theory of the police. Based on how the window is and the wound pattern, there is no way anyone could do it that way. Now, mind you, if your goal is to get the gun and he's asleep, why not just open the door before the shots? They think he opened the door after to grab the gun anyway, so why not just save yourself the contortion required to fit their theory? But we are going to get a recreation moment now. So our investigator, Scott Keller, got a car that was similar to Mulligan's, and they are going to adjust the window and seat to match the photos and reports. From there, they're going to see if it's possible to make the wounds in the way that the prosecution is claiming. So the report says that the person would have used their left hand to accomplish the task, so that's what they're going to try. A quick side note is that Sean is right-handed. As expected, it's incredibly difficult and awkward at that angle. You have to put your hand on the roof, which no fingerprints were there, in order to steady yourself, and you can't really get an upward angle for the nose shot. He was able to get to the two shots closest to him, as well as be about parallel with the nose, but not at an upward angle. He also couldn't reach the furthest shot above the right eye, nor the one directly between the eyes.
When a bullet enters a body, and I'm not a pathologist, but I've heard a lot of them testify, it leaves a track of how it entered the body. And so how could you get these shots way over here and up the nose from outside of the car? It's not going to happen. The path isn't going to be consistent with someone standing outside of the car. Why would they need to put five bullet wounds in his face, one of them being up his nose? Why would they need to do that?
6 months before the fourth trial, Sean is fixing up and clearing out their first real home. His mom and sister will live on the first floor, with him and Latia living on the second floor. In the paper, he read that the current district attorney, Dan Conley, wouldn't be seeking re-election after 16 years. So a new person, devoid of the current corruption, could get a fresh eye on the case. Although Conley could drop the case before he leaves office, and Sean hopes that he will do the right thing and drop the case. There are six candidates up for the primary. Dan Conley would never even speak with Rosemary about the case, and she plans to make sure that the next DA does. There is an Irish parade, so apologies in advance for some of the bagpipes that will be in the background of the clip.
It's very rare that things change politically. Can they? Yes. Will they? Who knows? Now, I still think it's an old boys network. I still think it's politically motivated. I still think that it's controlled essentially by white, male, Irish, Catholic members. The minority population is growing, but it doesn't have the same pull that the, you know, old boys network has. And I think Boston's always going to be the old boys network. We have a white DA. We have a white commissioner. You know, we have a white mayor. And we have Sean, who happens to be black. We have a white police officer. We get a lot of issues that we have to cover. And when people like the DA, Dan Connolly, makes statements saying, you know, we're confident that he's guilty, we're confident we're going to get a conviction, they're intended to poison the jury pool.
Rosemary and Sean sit down to go over the crime scene and what the timeline is according to the witness statements. So the theory by the Commonwealth is that at 3:01, Sean buys the diapers. He has a receipt for it, so that is a definite fact. At 3:05 a.m., Rosa saw a black male crouched who she claimed was Sean. At 3:15 a.m., at the intersection next to the Walgreens, Adolfo DeSalvo sees a small brown car speed through a red light. At 3:25 a.m., Rosa leaves the Walgreens and now sees the man, once crouched, standing at the phones with another man. At 3:30, Victor Brown says that two black men parked a brown VW Rabbit next to his home, ran through the footpath, and turned right, going toward the Walgreens. It would have been impossible for the two men Victor saw to also be the men that Rosa saw. Also, if we remember Victor's initial recorded statement in our first episode, he says that when he got home, he saw two men sitting in the car. He thought he saw a third person in the back, but didn't know whether or not they were male, female, black, white, whatever. And then went into his house. By the time that he got to the top of the stairs, the car sped off. So now he notices two black men park the car, get out, watches their path, and then also sees them speed off as well? Well, because this timeline didn't work for Rosa and her statement, the cops call Brown and ask him if his household clocks are set ahead. Brown suddenly remembers that his bedroom clock is set 10 minutes ahead, and suddenly was in quotation marks, and he adjusts his statement to now be at 3:20 a.m. It still doesn't fit, and they all have to keep changing their times in order to work with Rosa, but to the cops, this now allows the two men that Victor saw to also be the two men that Rosa saw.
How can you ever say convicting Sean Ellis is justice? How can you ever say that knowing everything that you know? They don't want justice, they want a conviction. They want to be right, because if they get another conviction, then all of this doesn't matter. Then they weren't really wrong. Then everything that a Sarah Robinson and Brazel did doesn't matter. And so that's why they're so convinced that they want to get another conviction against Sean. And my suggestion is that, go ahead, I dare you to do it. Because I'm confident that if a jury understands the entire picture of what happened here, that they're not going to get the conviction they're looking for.
Rosemary is not playing around here, okay? Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III moved him and his family to the roughest part of Boston in a mission to serve the poor. Now, power to them, because, honey, I could not have been his wife. It's a very noble cause, but she likes a certain amount of security in her surroundings. You know what I'm saying? Like, I have to know the walk score of a neighborhood before I move in, so I can know if I can walk my dog at night, or are we using pee pads to make sure we make it home safely? You know what I mean? It's 88, and it's the height of the crack epidemic, and he gets involved with the young people in the neighborhood, and in that, also learns about the cops who were routinely robbing these young men of money and drugs. Police told Reverend Eugene that Mulligan was dirty and that his dirt caught up to him. So cops know this guy is corrupt. This isn't the first person who's told us this statement. And so they know that he's dirty, and they were willing to let Sean rot in jail for life, knowing that he didn't do it. It just baffles the mind. We get a little history lesson of how Boston came to be by both Reverends Mark Scott and Eugene Rivers.
I think the thing that happened in Boston, we were talking about the Revolutionary War, so the Brits come, they get in a fight with the Brits, and the Yanks beat them up. And so the Irish come, they fight the Yanks, and they take over all kinds of institutions in the city. They take over the police. They take over the tea, right? Transportation system, right? They take over state government. They take over city hospital. They take over city government. They just control everything. They control all the jobs, and they're fighters.
The Irish love to fight, right? And they need somebody to hate, right? To really get this thing going, right? So you always got the blacks, and we're an inexhaustible resource, right? Right? So to their credit, in fighting the Yankees, they build their political manifesto, the whole Kennedy story, all of that, right? To their credit, the blacks don't have, in this city, the organizational infrastructure to engage in power aggregation. They don't do that. The reason that black people have not elected a black mayor in all this time, with all these white liberals, is that Boston consists of a bunch of Afro-Caribbean blacks. So they would not close ranks to elect anybody black because they'd be fighting over which islander the person was, right? I said, in that context, all you're going to do is be defeated.
So now we get to meet the six candidates who are vying for the Democratic nomination. Now, I say six, but really three of them have truly set themselves apart as the real front runners. And those three are Rachel Rollins, who is a black woman, mixed race, but she is black, whose father is a white Irishman and her mother is from the Caribbean, Barbados. And she's held positions as both the prosecution as well as the defense. Shannon McAuliffe is a white woman, similar in views to like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And then you also have Greg Henning. Now, Greg Henning is more of a conservative Democrat, and he is backed by the current DA, Dan Conley. He is a current prosecutor with the DA's office as well. Now, his vision is that Suffolk County will be a safe and vibrant community for everyone, no matter where they live. He wants the system to apply fairly to everyone. Shannon, who truly would have had my vote if I lived in Boston, she came out letting it be known how she feels. She feels this is a great opportunity to reverse the policies of the past 40 years under Flanagan, Martin, and Conley. It is clear to her that a prosecutor is not the answer. Next up, we have Rachel, who I just really couldn't place why I was apprehensive about her, but there was just something that wouldn't let me go for her at the full force that I kind of felt when I heard Shannon talk. I'm not sure. But she has seen the system from both sides, not just as a lawyer, but also as someone whose sibling went to prison. When asked about tactics that prosecutors use that make reluctant witnesses testify, such as using someone's child or CPS against them, and if he's used them in the past, Greg says no. he would never and would instruct his ADAs to never use those methods to get cooperation. Rachel, however, feels that when you require someone to testify and they have children in the home that could be removed, then you don't have to say you are threatening them so much as the behavior in itself is already threatening, which I completely agree with. So Rosemary and Jalise are talking about an email that they received from the prosecutor's office in regard to the reward money. He's saying that it would have been done by the police union and he doesn't have access to those files, so it would be faster for them to get a court order. Essentially, he's saying no one has documented a reward in this case despite a duty to do so. And this completely baffles Rosemary and Jalise because it's a cop killing. Why are documents missing in regards to a reward for a cop killing? Henning is going door to door and he's getting support, including minority support. He's backed by both the firefighters and the police unions. And Daniel Conley says that Greg is head and shoulders above the field. He's the most educated, the most intelligent. Yeah, he said that BS because apparently not talking out of their asses is a very big problem for some of the people here. And he also claims that he is the most experienced. Greg would simply be a continuation of the current policies and be another Dan Conley.
These debates, these forums, these conversations about district attorney are so important because we're really trying to change the role of district attorney. It's one of the most powerful positions within the criminal legal system. The whole narrative around public safety is rooted in these historical ideas of racialized notions of who is dangerous and who needs to be kept safe and from whom. And I think when people will actually go into the courtrooms and see who is sitting on the bench and advocating for the Commonwealth and defending the accused and ushering in people and handling the papers and making the life-altering decisions, typically, disproportionately, they're all white. And again, that's kind of the spirit behind what we're trying to do with this campaign is raise awareness. Because it's one thing to talk about mass incarceration and the gross racial disparities that exist, but it's another thing to see it play out, to walk into court and see everybody in positions of power who are white and then everybody else being black or brown.
So Rashawn Hall, who you just heard, is with the ACLU. And he is having the candidates, five of the six actually attended, for a debate regarding mass incarceration. Shannon speaks first, and she says that if you don't want to wait to fight mass incarceration, the opioid crisis, or families being ripped apart, then she is your candidate. Greg says that they need a candidate who not only knows the mission and work of public safety, but also knows that systems need to be put in place to give people a second chance. Rachel says that we deserve a criminal justice system where your wealth and race don't dictate your outcome in the system. And finally, where the office itself represents the very diversity that's in the room that they're in, that it doesn't currently. Rosemary's mom is fired up and she wants the people to pay for what they did to Sean. This whole family is just amazing and we stand, okay? Going through discovery, they find that Rosa and Ivan Sanchez, as well as Victor Brown, received reward money. No one seems to know where it came from or how much they got. Ivan Sanchez confirmed that he got money, but he nor Rosa know exactly how much. While addressing the court regarding the date of his next trial, they guesstimate that Victor received about $9,000, with Rosa and Ivan receiving $15,000. Now, who is Ivan and why is he getting money? Two things that I have no idea of, and they never address it exactly. Now, the department, the police union, and the Benevolent Society all say that they didn't pay them. So where did the money come from? The judge in that court hearing says that they will find out where the money came from. The next debate is held at the Sheriff's Department with inmates present to ask questions. 65% of the inmate population of the Suffolk County House of Correction is black or brown. In a commonwealth where only 18% of its population is that makeup. The first question asked is about police accountability. Greg says he absolutely will and has been involved in investigating police before. Rachel says that she has good relationships with police, but also has a proven record of filing lawsuits against them for civil rights violations as well as racial discrimination. Unlike the others on the stage, she also knows what it's like to visit someone in prison and also hasn't only interacted with black or brown people in the context of criminal behavior. Definitely something to look forward to in a district attorney. Now, Shannon brings out the stats that police kill about 1,000 people a year for the past 10 years, and yet only 54 charges total, with half of them being dismissed or found guilty, have been put forward. So we haven't really been doing that good of a job at holding police accountable. Do you kind of see why I like her? She feels like they need to spend money on holding police accountable rather than spending it on a fourth trial for Sean, where they know that the cops were convicted of illegal activities and are dirty. Now, I added the dirty part, but I picked up what she was throwing down. The New England chapter of the Innocence Project has an Innocence March, and Rosemary notes that she feels like his involvement in the project makes him feel empowered because for 22 years, his power was stolen from him. And this is his first opportunity to try to get some of that back. And he also wants everyone to know that he is innocent. Now, the Commonwealth offered Sean a deal after he got out and said that they would give him time served if he pled guilty. Sean refused because he wouldn't admit to doing something he didn't do. Too bad the same couldn't be said for Terry Patterson. In February 2006, Terry Patterson accepts a plea deal. The Supreme Court had overturned his conviction and ruled that the fingerprints were inadmissible, which were the key evidence for putting him away in the first place. None of his prints individually matched the prints on the car. You had to overlay them in order to get a match. Conley decided to forego another trial and offered him a plea deal in exchange for a guilty plea. Now, why the hell would you accept a deal when their bombshell evidence is now unusable? They literally have nothing on him. The guns had only Latia's prints on them. So there's literally nothing to put him on the scene, let alone at the murder. The timeline still doesn't even match up. So why the hell plead guilty? In his plea deal, he names Sean as the shooter. Now, this is where I feel like I would tear their case to shreds in court if I were a lawyer. So first you accuse Terry due to fingerprint evidence that there is no way to get the prints that they have there naturally, leaning towards planted evidence. The corrupt cops in this case And now they wanted to try to finger Sean as the shooter, which means they have nothing against Patterson. If they brought forth a new witness to say that Patterson was there, then you have to question where this person came from years later and why they weren't present before. Their credibility would be shot. So what case do you have? When Sean heard that Terry placed the blame on him, he was, and understandably is, still pissed off. He said whatever he had to say in order to not go back to jail. And this is why corruption in the system is so terrible. And even worse, that citizens don't know their rights, or those who do still get railroaded by corrupt cops. Sean asked for an attorney, and they still kept at it. But whoever was representing Terry at the time, why didn't they take him aside and have a conversation about what this offer truly signals? My feeling is that they don't offer plea deals if they have hard evidence to lock you up. If they have a rock solid case, they aren't going to offer you 5 to 10 years when they can easily get a sentence of life without parole, unless you are working for them, like in the Curtis Flowers case with Odell Hallman. Now, if you haven't heard of the Curtis Flowers case, I highly recommend checking out the In the Dark podcast. I am not sponsored and we have no relation, but I do love their podcast. And prepare to have your mind blown, because they tried Curtis 7 times. That's right, you heard me. 7 times. Rosemary feels like if Shannon were to get the nomination, it would be a definite that the case would be thrown out. And if Greg gets the nomination, then they're definitely going to be going to trial. At the preliminary hearing about payments to witnesses, the Commonwealth says that they have no reason to believe that payments were made other than the reward itself. However, based on the documents that they provided, they paid out $83,590.49 for something that they titled procuring evidence. Someone somewhere has to have the documentation about this, especially given the amount. They are still fighting for discovery that they should have had in the first trial, and the Commonwealth is still withholding it all. The reverends meet with the police union and Greg Henning. Now, they had endorsed Dan Connolly. However, they're disappointed because he never made it out there to actually help or have the conversation he promised them. So, pretty much, he pandered to get their vote and voice. And when it was done, he dropped the act and left them with their tails between their legs, if you will. So they ask if Craig will be different and come down if he were to win and have the conversation that they wanted to have with Dan. Shannon has the support of what appears to be the workers' union. Again, a little bit more of that Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders kind of feel here for her. She again acknowledges that slavery has direct ties to the criminal justice system that we have today and how it contributes to mass incarceration, the racial disparities, and whose crimes get solved and which crimes get more attention than others. So we get to this point, and it looks like there's only 2 of the candidates here. And it is kind of a little debate at a bookstore. And there's a kid who asks a question: at what point was the public having to try and get along with the police when a cop shot Antoine Rose in the back? Now, Michael Maloney, who we hadn't really seen much of up until this point, said that he wasn't sure if he really understood the question. I'll admit I honestly didn't understand it with that phrasing, but apparently Rachel did and interrupted him before he could finish his response. When people laugh, she says that it's not a joke. And not to cape for the guy, but I don't think he was joking or making light of it. Rather, it was kind of a weird phrasing. I rewound it multiple times, and honestly, she didn't exactly answer it. Just stated that black people are dying every day in the streets, and that's why she's running. There are people who have lost their lives due to systemic problems, and then goes on to say that she sued the police for discrimination. And if the cop does his job, then they will get along. But if they have racist content on social media, then they will be held accountable. Now, I don't know about you, but this still doesn't answer the question that was presented by the kid in question. The question was about the public's relationship with police and how that relationship played into the Rose situation. Or at least after rereading the question 20 times, that's kind of what I gathered from it. It's now election day, and the candidates are outside the polling locations doing some last-minute campaigning. Sean gets to vote for the very first time, which I guess since it was an overturned case, that means that he could, as convicted felons don't get the right to vote if my memory serves correctly. Rachel ends up winning the nomination with 38% of the vote, and then goes on to win in a landslide at the general election with 80% of the vote, becoming the very first woman of color to become the district attorney. When asked about the Ellis case, she says that if the case is still on the desk when she arrives, she will really look hard at the case. Personally, I would have preferred a more, hey, we're going to straight close the case like Shannon gave, but we will see what happens. And I do know what happens because I've been keeping up with the case. So that will definitely be in the next episode. And that ends this episode. Next up will be the final episode of this series, which will actually be dropping on Friday, so you will get two episodes this week. Monday will begin a whole new documentary, so I hope that you were excited and that you've enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Please rate and review the podcast to help get our podcast out there and amplify these stories. As always, you can find me on social media at Girl Meets True Crime on the IG, as the kids are calling it, and at Girl Meets TC on the Twitters. See you on Friday. Bye.